9:30 on Fight the Empire. Robert Perry is back to discuss how the Democrats have thrown in with the neocons on the issue of Russia. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on Between the Covers, we welcome author Melissa Phoebos and her novel Abandon Me, a story about how a woman's body and a body of literature hold memory. All of this great programming because of KBOO members and your generous support. If you're not a current member, please become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. It's $8.59.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. I was talking with my housemate just before I came in the studio. He said, "Revolution!" And I thought, oh yeah, revolution. that's where I wanted to go. Today, I'm not talking so much about revolution. I'm going to talk about dealing with a situation, which I don't have news. I don't have good news about. Willamette Week reporter Corey Payne posted a story about a racist convocation this past Sunday at the Southeast Portland beer bar called the Lucky Labrador. The self-admitted Nazis took over some table space and were actively recruiting with leaflets, making a big deal about them being Nazis and stuff. And they refused to leave and began peppering bar employee Elon Muskowitz with anti-gay slurs. Despite being outnumbered 2-1, the Lucky Lab staff ejected the Nazis, and good for them. Someone called the Portland police. When the Portland police arrived, according to the article, they did not file a report. And to me, that's the creepiest thing about the whole affair. I've said this before, but this is not a matter of free speech. The alt-right and their Nazi and Klan components exist as armed intimidation. Based on a lengthy and documented murder record here in the United States, holding a meeting or a rally for Nazi or Klan ideas is tantamount to a threat of injury or death to all persons other than non-Jewish cis white males. If you doubt that, think about what would happen if it were a meeting of ISIS. Well, ISIS is an armed group known for intimidation and for murdering people. Why is it different for Nazi or Klan? And of course, the reason is because they're white. And the fact that the Portland police did not file a report is a reflection of the tolerance they have for white armed terrorism. As a queer transgender person, I have a right and a duty to defend myself and my loved ones and community. That's all of you, from Nazis and the Klan. The Portland police need to issue a statement defining whether they stand with the KKK and the Nazis, or with the intended and historic victims of those terrorist gangs. In the meantime, I will stand against homophobic, racist intimidation by any means necessary. It's also my opinion that the Lucky Lab should be protected by this community. And, you know, I really didn't think I'd be saying that about the Lucky Lab. The Mercado, sure. The Yahoos are attracted, apparently, to the Portland Mercado, and we do need to stand up for them and for all of our community. But the Lucky Lab? Well, okay. That's the way it is. I think I'll be showing up in that vicinity. Now, I'm going to devote most of this program to one of the most immediate problems with the Commander-in-Chief. Article 2, Section 2 of the U.S. Constitution states, quote, "The President shall be Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy of the United States and of the militia of the several states when called into actual service of the United States," end quote. When called into the actual service. But the founding slave mongers didn't want the president starting wars, so they separated that power. Thusly, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 11 of the United States Constitution, sometimes referred to as the War Powers Clause, vests in the Congress the power to declare war in the following wording: the Congress shall have power, skip ahead, to declare war, grant letters of marque and reprisal, and make rules concerning captures on land and water, end quote. And if you're wondering what letters of marque were, they are essentially licenses given to pirates. How's that for antiquated? Since then, presidents have tended to view that part of the Constitution as optional, particularly since the nuclear war industry cranked up after the Second World War, and pointedly after Richard Milhouse Nixon decided he could bomb Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam whenever he felt like it. So Congress created the War Powers Resolution. Here again is Wikipedia's entry. By the way, I'm going to use Wikipedia a lot. I decided it's pretty easy for people to pull up and find the details and remember and corroborate. It's very democratic, and I like that, and it's working. And I should point out, since I'm going to use it so much, that it's supported by popular donations. Anyway, Wikipedia's entry in part says the War Powers Resolution, also known as the War Powers Resolution of 1973, or the War Powers Act, is a federal law intended to check the president's power to commit the United States to an armed conflict without the consent of the U.S. Congress. The resolution was adopted in the form of the United States Congress Joint Resolution. It provides that the U.S. president can send U.S. armed forces into action abroad only by a declaration of war by Congress, statutory authorization, or in the case of a national emergency created by attack on the United States, its territories or possessions, or its armed forces, end quote. So the War Powers Resolution requires the president to notify the Congress within 48 hours of committing armed forces to military action and forbids armed forces from remaining for more than 60 days, with a further 30-day withdrawal period. Without a congressional authorization for use of military force, that's the AUMF you hear about, or a declaration of war by the United States, the resolution was passed by 2/3 of Congress, overriding a presidential veto. Tricky Dick didn't like it. It's been alleged that the War Powers Resolution, writes Wikipedia, has been violated in the past, for example, by President Bill Clinton in 1999 during the bombing campaign in Kosovo. Congress has disapproved of all such incidents, but none has resulted in any successful legal actions being taken against the president for alleged violations, end quote. So, to review, the president, and you know what kind of president we have right now, either has or will arrogate the power of war, and Congress won't do a damned thing about it. It has to do with that military-industrial complex that Eisenhower tried to warn about. Congress depends on the handouts from the war industry very heavily. The business of the United States is war, and the profits that accrue from the intimidation that war creates. There are some side shops, to be sure, like mass incarceration, fossil fuel profiteering, but the whole enterprise depends on the dollar is propped up by aircraft carriers, nukes, and drone bombings. We live in the belly of that beast. This makes it all the more worrisome that a complete jackass has taken the reins of state. The latest news is that he has attempted to reinstate his racist ban of refugees from several predominantly Muslim nations, notably not Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Kyrgyzstan, and Egypt, which have actually admitted a few terrorists. His effort has again been slapped down by the courts, and he's obviously publicly frustrated with that. This follows his fact-free assertion that he had been wiretapped by the previous president, and it follows his bizarre and contrafactual assertions that his inaugural crowd was the biggest ever, etc. Taken together, his actions depict an obviously incompetent and deranged person. The executive branch now deals with a medical crisis by proposing to strip 24 million Americans of access to health care, and it deals with a global climate catastrophe by vigorously denying that CO2 is causing it. I will not say, however, that the groper-in-chief is lacking in cleverness. He obviously knows how to manipulate people on the basis of demagoguery and hatred, and it is in that context that I greatly fear the circumstances to be found in the Koreas today. Situation is dicey and possibly dire. And now the bumbling, raging, narcissistic fool in the Oval Office has been shoved upon the stage. What could go wrong? So I'm going to give you some details. And for those details, as I was saying, you can find most of what I'm going to say on Wikipedia. I've been spending days trying to wrap my head around what's really happening in Korea. There have been so many, thank God, there have been false scares about war between North and South Korea. And I was right here in 93 speaking into the mic that preceded this mic, talking about possibility of war, and we came very, very close, and Jimmy Carter saved us. I wonder how many people know that. How many people understand that a million people are alive today because Jimmy Carter went to North Korea. Fearless man. Apparently. So I have to couch my remarks accordingly. There have been many false scares, and I'm very glad that they were false. However, it's always been a real threat. And when it comes to this sort of threat, I think in terms of Russian roulette. Let's say instead of playing Russian roulette, you had a bizarre gun that had room, it's like mostly a rotor, a revolver with mostly a rotor, and you played Russian roulette by spinning a rotor with 20 spaces for bullets and only one bullet. Would you play that game? Why the hell would you play that game? You'd be risking a 5% chance, a 1 in 20 chance of getting your head blown off. Why do it? What's worth that? I think that the possibility of war in Korea right now, I mean right now, this second, is greater than 1 in 20. And there are reasons for this. I'm going to try to start at the beginning. Although many people are aware that the U.S. fought a war in Korea, 1950, fewer are aware that more than 33,000 U.S. soldiers died there, and that the total slaughter was over a million dead. Numbers like that pass quickly in a sentence and give only a glimpse at the horror. Americans are also led to believe that the Korean War was a straight-up confrontation with communism, and that is also a distortion of fact, whereas the initial tank assault against South Korea by Kim Il-sung was stocked with tanks and supplied by the Comintern, and Kim Il-sung was surely a communist, the desire to eject invaders and to unify Korea reflects a sense of Korean nationality that goes back thousands of years. Also, it's perfectly understandable, and also, it's just. It's a just cause. You have people invading your country. You have a right to shoot back at them and try to drive them out. I am not a pacifist. I admire pacifists. I can't say that I fully understand pacifism. If you turn it around, if North Koreans came into the country and I had half a chance, I would surely fire at them, murder them. You don't do that. I'm just trying to make the point, which is never made in the United States, that Koreans collectively have the right to get rid of the occupation. People switched sides during that war, sometimes out of survival necessity, and sometimes because their side was unbearably brutal, and probably some of them just thinking it's time to get rid of the invaders. There were massacres of civilians on both sides. Here's a quote from Wikipedia's entry on the war referring to the bombing terror. The first major U.S. strategic bombing campaign against North Korea began in late July 1950 and was conceived much along the lines of the major offensives of World War II. On the 2nd of August 1950, the U.S. Air Force dropped 625 tons of bombs on North Korea. 2 weeks later, the daily tonnage increased to some 800 tons. After the Chinese intervention in November, General MacArthur ordered the increased bombing campaign on North Korea, including incendiary attacks against their arsenals and communication centers, and especially against the Korean end of all the bridges across the Yalu River. As with the aerial bombing campaigns over Germany and Japan in World War II, the nominal objective of the U.S. Air Force was to destroy North Korea's war infrastructure and shatter their morale. And speaking for myself, that's a euphemism. It was an anti-civilian. It was an effort to wipe people out. And that's what they're hinting at. But returning to the text there, after MacArthur was removed as Supreme Commander in Korea in April 51, his successors continued this policy and eventually extended it to all of North Korea. Overall, the U.S. dropped 635,000 tons of bombs, including 32,000 and change tons of napalm on Korea, more than they did over the whole Pacific campaign of World War II. As a result, almost every substantial building in North Korea was destroyed. The war's highest-ranking American POW, Major General William F. Dean, reported that most of the North Korean cities and villages he saw were either rubble or snow-covered wastelands. North Korean factories, schools, hospitals, and government offices were forced to move underground. And I want you to remember that, because that's still true. And I want you to remember that because we're talking about nuclear war, and who would dare nuclear war? Well, maybe a population mostly capable of going underground might. It would be foolish, but they might. Anyway, returning to the text, as air defenses were virtually non-existent at the time, in November 1950, the North Korean leadership instructed their population to build dugouts and mud huts, as well as to dig underground tunnels in order to solve the acute housing problem. U.S. Air Force General Curtis LeMay famously commented, "We went over there, quote, and fought the war and eventually burned down every town in North Korea anyway, some way or another, and some in South Korea too," end quote. Pyongyang, which saw 75% of its area destroyed. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to visit. Hello, Americans. People who listen to KBOO might know where Pyongyang is. It's the capital of North Korea. Pyongyang, which saw 75% of its area destroyed, was so devastated that bombing was halted there as there were no longer any worthy targets. On the 28th of November, Bomber Command reported on the campaign's progress. 95% of Mampojin City was destroyed, along with 90% of Heryeong, Namsi, and Kwindong, 85% of Chosan, 75% of Sokchu and Huichan, and 20% of Wiju. According to USAF damage assessments, 18 of 22 major cities in North Korea had been at least half obliterated. By the end of the campaign, U.S. bombers had difficulty in finding targets and reduced to bombing footbridges or jettisoning their bombs into the sea. That's the end of the quote. And the trauma of that war was compounded by the anti-civilian tactic of bombing everything and everyone. The North Korean government has been known since for berserk and shocking tactics, and whereas they are the only ones who can answer for that, it is a fact that they faced a racially charged slaughter campaign from the U.S. and its allies. They are continually confronted, intimidated, and baited by annual war games called Full Eagle, Key Resolve, Ulchi Freedom Guardian. These war games expend months of each year, expend thousands of troops and billions of dollars. There was a time when the standoff at the Korean border was approximately equal. Since the South Korean economic growth of the 90s, that has changed. North Korea is, by comparison, a grim place dedicated to its rusting military infrastructure at the expense of a hungry population, while the South Korean expenditures as a percentage of gross domestic product have steadily dropped. That is not to say that the South Korean military is less supported. Quite the opposite. It's huge and quite modern. North Korea squeezes by. China shut down North Korea's coal exports lately, but according to the Japan Times, And this is the quote, North Korea continues to engage in trafficking illicit cigarettes in pharmaceuticals and ivory. According to a 2014 report compiled by an American human rights organization, smuggling narcotics in diplomatic bags, and they're printing high-quality counterfeit cash. It's been a mainstay of the country for 40 years. One of its schemes, according to Japan Times, for filling the financial gap consists of selling North Korean citizens into slave labor. According to human rights groups, Pyongyang has a pipeline pumping slaves into several European countries, including Poland, Malta, Germany, Italy, Austria, and the Netherlands. The North Korean officials vehemently deny it. Laborers are reportedly worked 6 days a week for up to 12 hours a day in shipyards, construction sites, and farms. They are paid, but up to 90% of their wages are sent back to Pyongyang. Though numbers are hard to come by, the best estimates have over 50,000 North Koreans working around the world, generating between $1.2 and $2.3 billion each year. Another illicit revenue stream comes from selling weapons on the black market. Despite UN sanctions, and we're talking about missiles here in part, big artillery pieces. Returning to Wikipedia, Pyongyang has been identified by human rights groups as selling small arms to buyers in Iran and Syria. Other major buyers include the Palestinian groups Hamas and the Popular Resistance Committee, to whom North Korea is accused of selling anti-tank missiles, shipping them through Sudan or Egypt. And I want to comment on that. The U.S. Also ships in anti-tank missiles to that theater. But anyway, the Namibian government admitted last year that Pyongyang has built arms and ammunition factories within its borders and plans to build more military infrastructure. End quote. So now, if you're thinking that has nothing to do with the human liberation proposed by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels in the Communist Manifesto, I'd have to agree. North Korea is socialist in name only. It's just mostly a bully place, and the North Korean people badly need liberation. But they surely do not deserve to be blown to bits, as would be the case with a resumption of the Korean War. And it would be a resumption because the Korean War never technically stopped. There's an armistice, but there's no end to the war, nor do South Koreans deserve such a fate. The dream is peaceful unification, and realistically speaking, that can only come about after the collapse of the Kim dynasty. So having said that, Americans who love war may be thinking that a war would just be the thing, or the only thing, that would resolve the situation, to which I would respond first that it isn't our business how Koreans resolve their affairs. And secondly, that these are people with hopes and dreams, just like you and I. Life is precious, if you haven't noticed, and war is murder. There's another aspect that few people think about, namely, South Korea could lose. A few of North Korea's troop tunnels have been found. It's impossible to find passages through granite 200 feet underground. They've been digging them for decades. The tunnels have been built up and have electricity, plumbing, troop barracks, and rail lines, again from Wikipedia. The Korean People's Army Defense Force consists of five branches: the Ground Force, the Navy, the Air Force, the Strategic Rocket Forces, and the Special Operation Force. The Worker Peasant Red Guards also come under the control of the KPA. KPA, Korean People's Army, faces its primary adversaries with 5,889,000 paramilitary personnel. It has the largest paramilitary organization on Earth. This number represents 25% of the North Korean population. North Korea relies on asymmetric warfare techniques and unconventional weaponry to achieve parity against high-tech enemy forces. North Korea is reported to have developed a wide range of technologies toward this end, such as stealth paint to conceal ground targets, midget submarines, and human torpedoes, blinding laser weapons. That's a cheap one, and they are said to have quite a bit of that. And probably they have a chemical weapons program, and they are likely to possess a stockpile of chemical weapons. The Korean People's Army operates ZM-87 anti-personnel lasers, which are banned under the United Nations Protocol on Blinding Laser Weapons. Since the 1980s, North Korea has also been actively developing its own cyber warfare capabilities. As of 2014, the Secretive Bureau 121, the elite North Korean cyber warfare unit, comprises approximately 1,800 highly trained hackers. In December 2014, you may remember the Bureau is associated with hacking Sony, making threats leading to the cancellation of The Interview, a comedy based on the assassination of Kim Jong-un. The Korean People's Army has made advances in electronic warfare by developing GPS jammers. Current models include vehicle-mounted jammers with a range of 50 kilometers to 100 kilometers, 62 miles. Jammers with a range of more than 62 miles are being developed, along with electromagnetic pulse bombs. The Korean People's Army has also made efforts to jam South Korean military satellites. Now, you may remember, speaking for myself, that, well, or not, depending on whether you're a Fox News viewer, that Saddam Hussein, in order to prove to the U.S. that he had new weapons of mass destruction, opened his country to IAEA inspectors, and his nuclear chemical weapons programs had been scrapped. By and large, there's scarcely anything left. This is not so with North Korea. They really do have the weaponry. And although I don't have much time in the program, I'll try to get some of the details to you. But I want to say that Kim Jong-un may view himself as the person to finally kick out foreigners from Korea. And the point I've been trying to make about how brutal the Korean War was, it sets context. If you look back at American statements and publications about the Korean War, they also were very brutal and very racist. And they came in the context of World War II, which was an incredibly desperate affair. I think that after so many generations, it might not be clear just how desperate it was. That was a war in which the tens of millions died, and it was not unusual to read in the papers that 50,000 people had been wiped out at once. An extremely desperate affair, and it resulted in extremely brutal thinking patterns in the American people and around the world. Just pragmatic thinking patterns under that context. And the point I'm trying to make here, this context has not been lifted from North Korea. As I said before, they're known for really disgusting and criminal actions. And that's their fault. You know, it's their call. But they are doing it in the context of their just cause, which is to repel invaders. That's absolutely their right. The UN certainly recognizes that. And they've done it and are doing it under the threat of nuclear obliteration, because the U.S. conducts, and the U.S. threatened nuclear war back in the 1950s, when they realized that they just couldn't keep up with the numbers of Korean and Chinese army personnel and with their determination. Eventually, the air war won it for the U.S. But nuclear weapons were moved into theater, and they were ready to go. And an order was signed but not delivered to begin nuclear war way back then. And that was, at that time, the Soviet Union had just begun to successfully test nuclear weapons. And right now, we're in a situation in which North Korea has just begun to successfully test nuclear weapons, and possibly they may have some ready to go. Or not. Maybe they're too huge and too clunky and too unreliable at this point. It takes a lot of money and time to develop nuclear weapons, but if you look at the development of rocketry, the North Koreans have kind of pulled that off. So, in this context, comes Donald Trump. And the context is about as bad as it could possibly get. I want to ask you, for example, as you know, earlier this year, Kim Jong-nam, the estranged elder half-brother of Kim Jong-un, was assassinated with VX nerve agent at the Kuala Lumpur International Airport in Malaysia. Malaysian investigators implicated 8 North Koreans, including a diplomat and a scientist, in the attack. And I have to ask you, why did North Korea use VX just to assassinate one person? And apparently the setup was to get 2 different women to spray 2 different components of VX nerve gas onto the hapless brother of Kim Jong-un. If Un had merely wanted to kill the man, there are easier and less internationally galling ways to do it. By using VX in its binary form, Un was saying to the world that he still has stabilized form VX. Since VX is an oily substance that sticks around in the environment, it is considered an area denial weapon. Consider that for a moment in terms of the ballistic missile threat to Japan. And consider that in terms of the revenge statements versus the U.S. This is a real threat. And I want you to consider that. And I want you to make a stink about it and insist that there be no war with Korea. Thank you for listening. This is Press Watch coming to you on 90.7 FM via our big red and white Eiffel Tower on the hill and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Dark Circle, is showing Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. Dark Circle is a documentary film that focuses on the connections between the nuclear weapons and the nuclear power industries. Again, that's Dark Circle, Thursday, March 16th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Well, good morning. This is Fight the Empire. My name is Per Fogring, and my guest today is Robert Perry, who is a longtime journalist, and he's a publisher of Consortium News.